Welcome to another edition of A Better You with Coach Caroline. I'm your host, Coach Caroline Miller, and today I'm so happy we're speaking with Dr. Jonathan Haidt, who is a professor in psychology at the University of Virginia. This year he is on a fellowship, I believe, at Princeton University, which he'll tell us about in a minute, and he's the author of the recently released The Happiness Hypothesis, which, trolling the web, I saw has gotten remarkable reviews from all over the world, including over in Europe. And we got to read it in galley form at the MAP program when I was there 2005-2006. So got a peek, advanced look at this great book, which everyone really should read. And that's what all the reviews say, you have to read this book. Jonathan's also the 2001 winner of the Templeton Prize in Positive Psychology. He's the 2004 winner of the Outstanding Faculty Award, which was conferred by Governor Mark Warner on 10 professors in the state of Virginia. And most importantly, he is a new father, the father of a little boy, and I believe his name is Max?
That's right, Max.
Congratulations. Boy, will that make you happy, and all over the map, the emotions that come up. Well, and so congratulations, and that segues right into happiness, our discussion about happiness. And we only have 15 minutes. So I do want to give a nod to your book in a moment, but I want to start with something really basic because people who listen to these podcasts are looking for introductory information, basically, to positive psychology. What is your definition of positive psychology? And please tell me why this matters in the study of human flourishing.
My definition of positive psychology, it's the scientific study of human flourishing. There, I said it quickly and briefly because I know we have a lot of time pressure. But if you want me to expand, I would say this matters because there are things that we can do to make our lives go better. The field of psychology had not been sufficiently attentive. Fields are driven by a variety of factors, none of which are really what is most useful to human beings. They're driven by fads. They're driven by the availability of funding. So psychology has been spending so much time studying the things that psychologists cared about, oppression, depression, all the negatives. As I see it, there were some low-hanging fruit, ready to be picked, some very simple questions about how can we find some simple techniques to make people's lives go better, to help them realize their potential, and that's positive psychology.
Great. And so that led you to your research all over the world, which you told us about at Penn, and then you distilled a lot of it into your book. Tell me why you wrote the book and what you learned from writing it and then sharing it with the rest of the world.
Mm-hmm. So my own research is on morality. That's how I started, and that's really how I think of myself. Along the way, I started studying this neglected area of morality, which is the positive moral emotions. We have so much research on shame and anger and the negative emotions. But when you think about the feelings you get when you see acts of virtue and heroism and courage, you feel something, and there's not even a name for that, really. There certainly wasn't any research at all. So I've been studying this emotion, which I called moral elevation, borrowing a term from Thomas Jefferson. And because I was doing that work, Marty Seligman invited me in 1999 to go to one of those early positive psych conferences because there were so few people who were studying these positive areas of human potential in a scientific way at the time. So that's how I got into positive psychology. The book itself, though, grows actually out of my Psych 101 class at the University of Virginia. I was a philosophy major as an undergraduate, and I always like to weave in bits of intellectual history and philosophy into my psych lectures, and it just got me thinking about certain big ideas that you found in different academic disciplines and to try to make sense of them all. And so I just conceived the idea of reading a bunch of ancient works, taking out every single psychological statement that they made, claims about reciprocity and virtue, and virtue is its own reward, and what doesn't kill you makes you stronger, just all sorts of claims. These are psychological claims, and we can evaluate them now, and that's what the book is. I just collected thousands of them, actually about 2,000, picked the largest clusters that I thought were interesting and wrote chapters on each, and that's how the 10 chapters of the book came about.
Mm-hmm. And what surprised you in the course of doing this work?
There were a couple of surprises. I originally thought that it would just be 10 separate chapters, but there was one theme that kept coming up, and that was the theme of relatedness. Even when I was writing about reciprocity, about turn-taking and the golden rule, the great truth being do unto others as you would have others do unto you, and there's tons of research on the benefits of reciprocity, well, it turns out that acting reciprocally brings you closer to others. Even mimicking others, if you just move your hands or your head in the same way as others, you end up liking them more and they end up liking you more.
Really?
So many of the chapters, relatedness kept coming through as this sort of spirit haunting the chapters, and ultimately led me to the great conclusion at the end of the book. Well, great in my, I'm not saying that it's this wonderful conclusion, just great in that it's this great overarching conclusion, which is, well, all right, I'll give it away right now. The book, the ultimate theme of the book is that happiness comes from between. It's not just a matter of getting what you want. It's not just a matter of renouncing things and getting your desires right. Happiness comes from getting the right kind of engagement between you and other people, between you and your work, and between you and something larger than yourself. And that was a surprise to me. I didn't know that when I started the book.
Well, that's so interesting, because it sounds like you've expanded on this even since I read The Galleys and heard you speak. Angela Duckworth said something when I interviewed her about grit and how grit can be contagious, and that's why people at West Point feel that if you want to get grittier, be around gritty people.
Absolutely.
Do you find that is true also with being around people who awe-inspire you? Does it awe-inspire you to do other wonderful things?
Mm-hmm. Absolutely. The area that I'm getting into now more and more is an area that I discovered from writing the book, and it's something I'm calling informally hive psychology. As though human beings are in a way designed to be like bees in a hive. Bees evolved to live in hives, and in a sense, the hive is the organism, and the bee is just a cell in the body.
Mm-hmm.
I believe that this is true about humans too, although to a much lesser extent. And part of our hivishness is optional. We can live as individuals, and that's the way most of us in the modern West live, or we can live as members of a hive, and certainly in the military, that's the premier place that you find hivishness in the United States. I think hivishness is part of our nature, and in a way we need it to really be happy, to be the most deeply, profoundly happy that we can. This is why it is so hard to be happy just by yourself or by accumulating material resources, because really it's a matter of engagement. So you mentioned to me, I don't know if I can reveal this, but you just mentioned to me that you had joined a Bible study group.
Yes. Mm-hmm.
And that you hadn't told me about the benefits of it, but you seem to think that it's made a big difference in your life. I think this is the great wisdom of religion, is that religions serve the function. Religions are diverse, but religions serve the function of binding people together into communities that inspire each other and care for each other.
Mm-hmm.
So I think this is one of the most basic aspects of human life and human happiness and human satisfaction, which the scientific community has not taken seriously enough, because we're almost all atheists, and I am too. But I've really come to respect religion quite a lot for what it does.
Huh. Well, that leads me into kind of a related question, which is awe and elevation around being a father. Tell me how parenthood has changed your feelings about joy, elevation, awe-inspiring things.
Yeah. Gosh, it's hard. It's hard to parse the words and to figure out which words work. My friend Dacher Keltner, who's one of the leading researchers in social emotions and in awe, had told me that the birth of his children was the most awe-inspiring event of his life. And so, in a way, I was prepared for that. But I don't know what I felt when my son was born. It was such overwhelming relief, because I was just so afraid he was going to die in delivery. I was just haunted by that fear.
Mm.
So I'm not sure that what I felt was awe. It was certainly the most unusual and overwhelming experience of my life, but I'm not certain that it was awe, other than just the fact that it's just so bizarre and incredible what happens. But I would say that for me, so at the time, on the day my son was born, my wife was already in love with him. She had had a relationship with him for 9 months, and I had not. My relationship with him started on the day he was born. So what I noticed is that over the following months, I fell in love with him. That just as in romantic love, it grows. Well, romantic love can start quite quickly, but when you care for someone, you change the diaper and help with the feedings and all that. So what I really discovered was just that I fell madly in love in a way that I thought you'd never get to do again once you're married, but you do when you have kids.
Mm-hmm.
And I know that Dan Gilbert has written that children decrease satisfaction. I think we need to look very closely at the data that that's based on. I think when you are raising children under good circumstances, I think that it is a tremendous catalyst for joy. And this has been the happiest 8 months of my life and my wife's life.
Oh, that's wonderful to hear. And I think that kind of fits with some of the research I've been reading on happy families. And I think Barbara Kerr talks about plants, pets, and photographs. Being in abundance in happy families, and I'm assuming
interesting.
Isn't that? I'm trying to track that down and interview her if she shows up on the podcast.
Right. Those are all markers of relatedness. Well, the plants may be not relatedness. The plants may be more a love of beauty. But the pets in the photographs, those all reveal highly related people. People have a lot of between.
Right, and you also have to extend yourself to care for a plant, to care for a pet.
Okay, oh, you're right. You're right, and then there's those classic nursing home studies by Judith Rodin about just giving people in nursing home plants to care for. It's the act of caring.
Mm-hmm.
The act of caring draws out something that is important in us that needs to be expressed.
Right, and I think it's just, it's right. I mean, there's so many interesting things that are there to study that are new and different. We can pull them together. My last question, depending on how many minutes it takes to go through this, is you were kind enough to share your PowerPoints when I taught on the Gratitude Cruise last month, and I shared with them your character improvement project at UVA. And I wanted to hear a little bit from you about why you decided to do a character improvement project as a final project, and what you've learned from watching students go through it, and maybe if we have a minute or two about Sarah's project and how you said
sure.
It was so profoundly changing, life-changing for her.
Yeah. So I was inspired, to teach a positive psychology class by Marty Seligman, who taught the first one in, you know, at least within positive psych, and who said it was the most fun he'd ever had, and he was doing all these different things and the gratitude visit and all sorts of things. And so when I designed my course, I had a couple of sort of design criteria. And one was that it would not be primarily about learning ideas. It would be about doing things. I think that one thing I've noticed is that students really want to understand themselves, for one. And another that I've always known is that when you do projects, when you apply knowledge, you get to keep it. And so I structured the class around projects that the students would be able to, in which they would be able to apply the materials, ideally for their own benefit. Mm-hmm. And what better benefit than actually asking them to conceive of how to make themselves better people? So that's the project. The course is really structured around this gigantic final project, which is make yourself a better person by the end of the semester and prove it. So you have a couple of weeks to begin to formulate how you would want to change yourself or what you would want to change. Then you have a few more weeks as we learn of various techniques, cognitive therapy and positive emotions, all sorts of things, to figure out a method, because I tell them right up front, you cannot use the direct method. You cannot say, I want to be more generous. So when an opportunity arises to be generous, I will be generous. That is guaranteed to fail. So you have to be more clever than that. You have to think about your mind as being divided between a rider and an elephant. The elephant is the automatic processes. And you have to think about how to train your elephant, how to change the relationship between the rider and the elephant. So you have to come up with a psychologically sophisticated method, and then you have to have an assessment technique. You have to have measurements to figure out whether or not you succeeded in change. And it's very hard to change. But over the years, the success rate has gone up, and it's now about 70 or 80% of the students are able to document actual improvement in their character, in their behavior, over the course of the 13 or 14 weeks. So self-change is possible, but it can't be done just by passing resolutions. You have to be sophisticated, use the latest tools of positive psychology, and see it as a long-term project to change your automatic responses. And if you think of it that way, it can be done.
And so it's in direct opposition in some ways. I mean, what you're saying is it's hard work, and you have to be intentional and focused about it. The book that everybody's buying and reading is called The Secret. And
oh, God, that is such malpractice. That is so irresponsible. It's such nonsense.
Well, I think it's not grounded in what I teach either, so
yeah.
I'm going to agree
no,
with
it's just,
you.
No, it's, you know, it's magic and prayer. It's just, you know, this sort of thing comes and goes every 10 or 20 years. It's, you know, and look, the research shows that positive thinking has no effect on cancer. There have been a lot of studies. You can't cure your cancer just by thinking good thoughts or by wishing or believing that your cancer will be cured. It's just absolute nonsense that preys on people's hopes and naive desires.
Mm-hmm. And I think what you've shown, and certainly what I've seen in my own teaching of the research around goal setting and goal accomplishment, is it's hard work, and it's something you need to be intentional, focused, and work on. And as Sarah's project showed that you shared with me in the PowerPoint, is once she stopped writing her blessings down, her well-being began to go down too.
Oh, okay. Yeah, I forgot about that little twist to it. Yeah, the basic idea of her project was that she discovered that she has problems with optimism, not so much because she, when bad things happen, she dwells on them. That's the classic pessimism. What she discovered is that when good things happen, she tends to dismiss them. And so she chose to work on that, and she developed this really clever – so she did a variety of techniques. I think it was mostly cognitive therapy, and she had a few other techniques. And but she had this very clever assessment technique, which was at night, every night, she would write down as many good things that had happened to her that day as she could in 2 minutes. And she had a stopwatch, and what she found was that in the first couple of weeks, she had a lot of trouble thinking of things. But about five or six weeks into the project, it was like the floodgates opened, and she felt happier, she found more good things. And I thought it was so interesting that it took 5 or 6 weeks, which is the same amount of time as it takes with Prozac.
Right.
I found that in a few projects that I don't know for sure, but I suspect that if you really want to change the neural structure or the hormonal structure in your brain, you can't do it by passing a resolution. You have to develop habits, and then 5 or 6 weeks later, the neurons change.
That's interesting, and that mimics Richie Davidson's work on 8-week meditation class.
That's right. You're right. Barbara Fredrickson presented that work, and it was around at week 6, I think, that they, the last assessment, that they really showed a big jump.
So 6 weeks is really the optimal time for working at change, right? That's when the key turns in the lock, or at least it appears to be that way.
Yeah, that's right. I mean, some people actually seem to get results right away. Other people will take longer, but it does seem as though for many people something happens after about 5 or 6 weeks. A habit really begins to set. The brain begins to respond. The elephant begins to change. There's a little work showing that you need to keep the habit going for 11 weeks in order to have it stick. So even if you start to get benefits at 6 weeks, if you then say, okay, I'm done, I'm cured, you're likely to lose it. But if you can keep it up for 11 or 12 weeks, things just become much easier.
Wow. Okay, well, I'm mindful of the peak end rule. We're going to end.
Okay.
We're going to end right there because you have to go, and that's such a great point. I'm going to listen to this again, and just want to really thank you. I found you were one of the most provocative lecturers I heard at Penn, and you continue to be, and I can't recommend your book highly enough, The Happiness Hypothesis, and there will be a link right next to this podcast. So I just wanted to say this concludes today's podcast with Dr. Jonathan Haidt. So please visit my website, www.carolinemiller.com. Click on the blinking podcast link to learn more about today's guest. And until next time, this is Coach Caroline wishing you a happy, proactive, and very, very successful day.
Thanks, Carolyn. Bye-bye.